All right. So we are just finishing up the sixth question. Who are the two, this is review, the two witnesses that we talked about last week? And in general, I think they represent all of the Old Testament prophets. There's very definitely a situation where we are seeing that it is Moses and Elijah, as Mike Clark pointed out last week. And so consequently, the two witnesses are also the law and the prophets, which Moses and Elijah both represent symbolically. And we see Moses and Elijah symbolically in at the Transfiguration. We see them symbolically in that John the Baptist was the Elijah that would come, and Jesus was the prophet that was going to be like Moses that would come. We saw the fact that they both called down fire on those who opposed them. That's from verse 5 of chapter 11. We see the plagues, the water in the plagues of Exodus 7 through 13, the water being turned to blood. Elijah, the drought, and the drought was 3.5 years, 42 months, 1260 days. I mean, it's just layer on layer on that. And like John, Elijah was a forerunner of one who would have a double portion of his spirit, which was Elisha. And like Moses, John was followed by a Joshua. And Joshua, obviously, is a Hebrew name for the Greek name Jesus. And so, again, just that back and forth. So, again, I think that these two witnesses summarize the law and the prophets and all of the prophets that were there. And so that brings us now in chapter 11 of Revelation to verses 7 through 10. And the scene just changes abruptly here. It says, now when they had finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them, speaking of these two witnesses, and overpower and kill them. Their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. For 3.5 days, men from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. The inhabitants of the earth or of the land will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts, because those two prophets had tormented those who live on the earth or slash the land. And so that brings us to question 7, which is where we got to last week. Briefly tell what happens to the two witnesses. And the two witnesses have finished their testimony, and we're told that the beast of the abyss ascends out of the abyss. He's coming up out of that. And he makes war against them, he overcomes them, and he slays them. And we are told that their testimony was to go out into all the earth. And so what we have up here right now is slide 41, which you don't need to know about, but Matthew, the 24th chapter, and verse 14, where Jesus said, in talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. And now let's go to the next slide, Tim. Which is passages from Colossians chapter 1 and verse 6 and 23. In the same way, the gospel is bearing fruit and growing throughout the whole world, just as it has been doing among you since the day you heard it and truly understood God's grace. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, had become a servant. Then in chapter 10 of verse 18, Paul said, did they not hear? Of course they did. Their voice has gone out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. And so from the standpoint of what Jesus said was going to have to happen before the end would come, we see by the time that these epistles had been written that that had been accomplished in whatever Jesus meant by what he said in Matthew is what has been accomplished now. And so Jesus said, and then the end will come. And so now the end can come. Now, we haven't seen or heard of this beast before this point in the vision. This is, in fact, the first mention of the beast in Revelation. And I need you to understand that beast imagery is very powerful in the Bible. The beast is always that which is opposed to God. It's always that which is opposed to man. And in fact, when we come to the garden in Genesis, the third chapter, who caused their fall? Just say it out loud. The serpent, who is a beast. And in fact, when God, when they came to know their sin, God clothed them with what? With animal skins, because they looked more like beasts than they did him anymore. They didn't bear the image of God anymore in their sin. Nebuchadnezzar, in Daniel, when he was lifted up and said, look at all that I have done, what fell down on him? What curse did he endure? He became a beast. And he ate grass like cattle. He had hair like a bird. Or his hair became like birds and claws. Go over to Psalm 22. I don't have this up there, but you can turn over there, all of you. Psalm 22 is that very amazing psalm about the crucifixion, a prophetic psalm about that. And in the picture of Psalm 22, what surrounds the Messiah on the cross in verses 12 through 13? Yeah, many bulls of Bashan. And then also further down in this text, in verse 16, what is surrounding him? Dogs. And so again, we have beasts who are here. And even, and again, I'll have, this is on the slide, even those who ministered as priests before God had to have that distinction made. Let's go to slide 43, please. Yep. This is in Ezekiel chapter 44, verses 17 and 18. When they enter the gates of the inner court, speaking of the priests, they are to wear linen clothes. They must not wear any woolen garment while ministering at the gates of the inner court or inside the temple. They are to wear linen turbans on their head and linen undergarments around their waist. They must not wear anything that makes them perspire. Okay, so the perspiration is important here. What's the difference between linen and wool? Linen is plant-based. Wool comes from an animal. And so the priests were not even allowed to wear something that pertained to an animal. They were not allowed to wear wool around them. Because wool is from a beast. So, listen, the enemy of God's people has always been depicted as a beast. Now, this particular beast comes out of the abyss, which automatically makes it have an association with Satan. The abyss is this dark, raging deep, the abode of Satan, the abode of his demons, periodically released by God to torment evil men or used by God in that way when they commit apostasy. And I, again, don't have this, but if you'll skip back to Luke chapter 8. It's so interesting what happens in my brain as far as sermons and classes and all of those things. I'm talking about Luke 8 here. I'm preaching from Mark 9, or going to mention Mark 9 in my sermon Sunday. And by the way, when I was looking at that, I realized I skipped this whole part of Mark when I was going through Mark. And so look forward to that. Come back to the demoniac with regards to that. But here is Jesus meeting Legion. And in verse 30 of Luke 8, what is your name, Legion? He replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged him in verse 31 repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. They don't want to go back there. They didn't want to go back there. And instead, what did they ask Jesus to do? To go into a herd of pigs. Listen, demons are always bent on destruction. They want to destroy something. And so this was a venue for them in which to do that. And where do the pigs go? Over the cliff into the deep. So kind of an ironic thing that Jesus allowed them to do something that ended up putting them where they didn't want to go. I just think that's kind of interesting. So keep in mind as well, though, that the abyss is ultimately controlled, as all things are, by God. And I believe that the manifestation of this beast here is Rome. The beast is Rome. Because it's by Rome, by the power of Rome, that the practice of the law and the prophets will cease. Because they're the ones who are going to destroy the temple. They're the ones who are ending that whole system. So, getting back now to Revelation, having talked about that part of it, it says that their bodies will lie in the street, and in the street of the great city, and we have it described for us in three ways, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, and where also their Lord was crucified. So, their dead bodies are going to lie in the street of the great city. Let's go to slide 44. Matthew, and this is a passage, text we've seen many times. So, and so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom he murdered between the temple and the altar. And so here's righteous blood that's being shed in Jerusalem. In this particular case, it's figuratively being done. And figuratively or spiritually, it is Sodom and in Egypt. Listen, there are several references in the Old Testament to Jerusalem being a Sodom. I have one example for you coming up on this next slide in Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 14. And among the prophets of Jerusalem, I've seen something horrible. They commit adultery and live a lie. They strengthen the hands of evildoers so that not one of them turns from their wickedness. They are all like Sodom to me. The people of Jerusalem are like Gomorrah. And so that's just one example. Obviously, I could give you more. Now, there's a lot of people that wrestle with the fact that here in the text it says that they are called Sodom and Egypt, and they wonder about the Egypt. This is maybe a little bit not as clear, but it's very plain at the same time, because Jesus is our Moses, who's leading us out of bondage in sin. In Luke, the 9th chapter, in verse 31, at the Transfiguration, what did Moses and Elijah talk to Jesus about? Anybody remember? About his exodus. They're going to talk to him about his exodus. And all of these judgments that we have seen here remind us of the plagues that God brought on Egypt. And now he's pouring them out on another Egypt, which in this case is Jerusalem. Yes, Megan.
Just kind of a connection thought that I had was that Moses led them out of Egypt, so that's kind of that comparison with Jesus leading us out of bondage. But also with the Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot was led out of Sodom and Gomorrah, and then Abraham, who was his uncle, but kind of a similar like father figure to him. Kind of like that relationship between God, his son,
okay,
and then saving us.
Okay. So Megan was making a connection between Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot being led out from there. But the key here to me, and this is what kind of seals the deal for me with regards to this great city where these two witnesses were killed, and that is where we are told where also their Lord was crucified. And where was the Lord crucified? He was crucified in Jerusalem, and not obviously in Rome. Next slide, Kim, Luke 13, verse 33. In any case, I must press on today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem. And so the scene here in Revelation is one of grave oppression, where these two witnesses are killed and are left in the street. They are not buried. And in Scripture, the fact that the dead are not buried is a sign of severe, and depicts severe persecution. Let's go to the next slide. Psalm 79, verses 1 and 3. O God, the nations... somebody's asked, why did the Legion not want to go back in the abyss? Nobody wants to go in the abyss. The demons don't want to be there. They'd rather be out in people or pigs even, rather than going back to the abyss. It's a place where they don't want to be. Psalm 79, 1 and 3, O God, the nations have invaded your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have reduced Jerusalem to rubble. They have left the dead bodies of your servants as food for the birds of the sky, the flesh of your own people for the animals of the wild. They have poured out blood like water all around Jerusalem, and there is no one to bury the dead. So this is, again, a prophetic statement about what the nations have done or will do to God's people. I'm sure that that was the case even before in other invasions that took place. The nations here... in Revelation chapter 11 and verse 9, says that the nations will gaze on their bodies and refuse the burial. And so these are the Gentiles here that are involved in that. Now Psalm 2 and 3, the next slide. The kings of the earth rise up, and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. And so... they are joined now by the people of the land, and that's where we have in verse 10, the inhabitants of the land, the inhabitants of the earth, will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts. And so the people of the land are rejoicing. Listen, friends are sometimes two people that have a common enemy. They may not have anything else in common. The nations hated the Jews because of their God and the law. The Jews hated to be different. They wanted a king like the people around them. They wanted to be accepted by those. And they themselves were tormented by their difference. And we certainly see their partnership in the crucifixion of Christ. It's the Jews who bring Jesus to Pilate. And it's the Jews who are trying to get Pilate to kill him. And everyone sided with the beast in this case. To destroy the Lord, the anointed one, as David refers to him here. So then in verse 11 through 14 of Revelation 11, but after 3.5 days, so here's that 3.5 again, after 3.5 days, a breath of life from God entered the two witnesses, and they stood on their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up to heaven in a cloud while their enemies looked on. At that very hour, there was a severe earthquake, and a tenth of the city collapsed. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the survivors were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. The second woe is past. The third woe is coming soon. So everybody's happy that the two witnesses are dead. They're all celebrating, they're having a big party, but the party didn't last very long because it's only 3.5 days. Again, that is a period of time, as we've told you a couple of times already, and I just want to remind you of that this is a time when it appears that the wicked are having triumph. They seem to, but after this period of time, after this 3.5 days, they are revived and they stand up. And they were raised when Jesus was raised, in essence. In fact, we see that happening in the Gospels, in Matthew, that after Jesus' resurrection, many saints went into the city. And I don't know if some of those were some of those great prophets that were raised. They were shown to be true. In fact, they still stand today. They did not survive the persecutions. All those prophets that died didn't survive the persecutions, but in Christ they rose again. And obviously God is able to turn defeats into victories. God's triumphs are often disguised as tragedies. And that's kind of a good rule of thumb to realize. They are caught up to heaven with the same invitation that John got in Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1. Come up here. And... That's in slide 41, which is a picture of that event there, as these two witnesses are caught up into heaven in a cloud. At the same moment, there was a great earthquake. And when that earthquake happened, a tenth of the city fell. What is a tenth? That's another word that we use for tenth. A tithe. So this was God taking his tithe out of the city as a warning of what's going to follow. And listen, the temple was approximately one-tenth of the size of Jerusalem. And, of course, it's going to fall. It was the heart of the city. And when the temple fell, the heart of the city died. We are told that 7,000 are killed. Anybody remember how many were faithful in Elijah's day? 7,000. This is the opposite. There are 7,000 wicked here. Because those who saw the sign that the city was surrounded by Rome when Cestius came and then drew back, the Christians that were there, they left. And the faithful left the city. So as we look back here, the first woe, as you recall, we talked about, were the seditious Jews. The killing of each other in the city. The second woe is when Rome enters into the city. And there is, as we were told in chapter 8 and verse, 13 there, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, because the trumpet blasts. And so we had a first woe and we had a second woe. We're not told about the third woe. I'm assuming that the third woe is a total destruction of Jerusalem. But that's not a part of the, we're not told that. We just know it's coming. The second woe is past, the third woe is coming soon, but we're not told specifically what that is. Any questions or comments so far? All right, let's look at verses 15 through 19. The seventh angel sounded his trumpet. So this is the last angel, the last trumpet. And there were loud voices in heaven which said, the kingdom of our Lord has become the kingdom of, the kingdoms of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. And the 24 elders who were seated on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, we give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was, because you have taken your great power and have begun to reign. The nations were angry and your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead and for rewarding your servants, the prophets, and your saints and those who reverence your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroy the earth or the land. Then God's temple in heaven was open, and within his temple was seen the Ark of the Covenant. There came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and earthquake, and a great hailstorm. So your question 8 that I asked you pertains to this: what occurred when the seventh angel sounded his trumpet? And as we had with the seventh seal, worship starts. The seventh trumpet is sounded, and all of a sudden we have worship. In chapter 10 and verse 7, says, in the days when the seventh trumpet is about to sound his trumpet, the mystery of God will be accomplished, just as he announced to his servants the prophets. So when it sounds, it's finished. Like the creation of the world was finished on the seventh day. The kingdoms of this world. I did. How many of you knew that out of Revelation 11, 15 is where Handel got the words for the Messiah? The kingdoms of the world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. Yeah, I sang it back in high school, so that's why I probably didn't get the tune exactly right. Let's go to the next slide there, Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring to an end, but it will itself endure forever. And the days of those kings was the fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, in Daniel chapter 2. And the reign began after his ascension. It was announced on the day of Pentecost that it had happened. But even though the kingdom was announced and had been established, there still was a rival which was the Jewish system, which had to be removed. Very similar to the fact that when God's anointed followed Saul, David, for 7.5 years, there was a rival, Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, continued to reign for a short time until he was removed. And you see in this chorus of praise in verse 18, again, an echo of Psalm 2 and 2 that we just looked at. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead and for rewarding your servants, the prophets, and your saints, for those who reverence your name, both small and great. So we have the vindication of the dead, those who were under the altar that we saw under the seven seals. They cried for vengeance. They have been avenged, and both prophets and saints, both small and great. And upon those who destroyed the land, let's go to slide 51, Matthew chapter 23, verses 34 through 36. Therefore, I'm sending you prophets and sages and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. Who's he talking to here? Is he talking to Romans, or is he talking to Jews? It's Jews. They're the ones who have the synagogues. And so upon you, Jews, will come all of the righteous blood that has been shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly, I tell you, all this will come on this generation. So it's not on the Romans, but it's on the Jews. In fact, if you go over, and I don't have this up there, but in your book of Revelation, go over to chapter 19, getting a little ahead of ourselves here, but just kind of a sneak peek here. Revelation chapter 19 and at verse 2. For true and just are his judgments. He has condemned the great prostitute who corrupted the earth by her adulteries. He has avenged on her the blood of his servants. And so again, this great prostitute is not Rome. It's Jerusalem that God is speaking about there. Who is guilty of all the blood of all the servants of God? And it's Jerusalem. So again, Jerusalem is the great prostitute. You can remember that when we get over to Revelation 19, that we already covered that. And then we see that the temple of God was opened in heaven, and the ark was seen. So the ark was, and the temple obviously in heaven, and the ark itself was not given to the Gentiles to trample. The physical copy on the earth was. It was destroyed and everything that pertained to it, but this one, the heavenly one, is protected. And I don't know why I didn't have this passage up there on your screen, but 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 16, and this is a text that you're very familiar with. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? And so that temple was not trampled. They got out. We're safe. We're always safe. The Gentiles have nothing to do with us. And that ark that contains the law, in this case, is your heart. It's where it's been written. So this was kind of, as we're getting towards the end of chapter 11 here, is the final display of God's power. I didn't come up with this, but I liked it. This is not the beginning of the end. This is actually the end of the beginning of what God is going to say to the people. So any comments or questions about chapter 11? Pardon me, Tim?
You had just talked about Psalm 2.
Yeah, the kings of the earth raging.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go on to chapter 12. We can at least get the introductory material here that I have for you. And I'll wait for Tim to bring it up. This chapter 12 is the woman and the dragon that we're going to be looking at here. So we've got two signs that are going to show up here. And my Bible has the woman and the dragon, which makes it very convenient for me to not have to make stuff up. And I was, as I was studying for this week's class, I realized that I had never given you a real general overview of the entire book of Revelation. The book itself follows the form of a treaty of kings and of a great king who is got a vassal king under him now, and so this is the agreement, this is the treaty, this is what you'll do. Here's what's going to happen if you don't do what I say, and all of that. And so let's go to slide 2 on this. And it gives us kind of I'll give you the overview of the whole book. Obviously, chapter 1, we have the introduction of the Son of Man. And then in chapters 2 and 3, it talks about the things that are. John was supposed to write about the things that are and the things that will be. And the things that are the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3. The third part of this treaty is that you're going to have to be loyal to the new king, to the new emperor. And that's really covered in chapters 4 through 7. And what goes along with that are the seven seals. And then that's followed by the curses and blessings of the treaty. Blessings if you do what I say, curses if you don't. And that's what we're just in the process of looking at here. And that's the seven trumpets in chapters 8 through 14. And then we have the judgment and completion of the whole process where the old rival is taken out, the new kingdom is going to be established, the new Jerusalem's coming out of heaven, and there's no one to rival it any longer. And there we have the seven bowls that really depict that for us in chapters 15 through 22. So, and you can see, obviously, it's very clear there are the seven churches, the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls make very nice division of that. Listen, this kind of treaty and these things is echoed in Deuteronomy as Moses is talking to the people about what God expects of them and what will happen if they're faithful and all of that, or if they're not. So as we're going through Revelation, there is this progressive development as we proceed from chapter 4 all the way through chapter 22. But there's also going to be a repetition of familiar concepts like the sevens and the judgments and those types of things. So, but we're going to finally make our way to a very grand climax at the very end of Revelation in chapters 21 and 22. Now, the next slide gives you kind of a quick arrangement of chapter 12 that we're about to go into. We have in verses 1 and 2 the messianic sign. In verses 3 and 4, we have the casting out of Satan. Then in chapter 12, I'm sorry, I think I said chapters 3 and 4, verses 3 and 4. Verses 5 and 6 talk about the persecution of the woman and the exaltation of the child that you will understand as we're going through this. Verses 7 through 12 is an explanation of the actions that were taken in verses 3 and 4 with the casting out of Satan. And then verses 13 through 17 is a return to the theme of verse 6 and an explanation of what has happened. So that kind of gives you a heads up of what we're going to... I think we have time to go through this first part here. Verses 1 and 2. And so in verse 1 and 2, it says, a great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. So let's go to slide 4. And this is the depiction of this woman. And listen, this is a great and wondrous sign. Listen, the whole book of Revelation is a book of signs. And so when John tells you that this sign that I'm about to tell you about is great and wondrous, he's basically saying, you need to take note of this one. This one is an important one. You need to think about this carefully. And so he describes a woman for us here. She's clothed with the sun. The moon is under her feet, and we have 12 stars in the garland on her head. And so we can guess just from this that she has some connection with God and that she is a good woman. She's also with child and crying out in labor to give birth. Now, the use of a woman is a familiar Old Testament image for the people of God. It's used today too. What is the church? The bride of Christ. And I don't have this up there because I couldn't get the entire book, but I want you to go over to Ezekiel chapter 16. And this is a particularly graphic description of the people of God and of Jerusalem specifically. Verse 3, this is what the Sovereign Lord says to Jerusalem. Your ancestry and birth were in the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite, your mother a Hittite. On the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to make you clean, nor were you rubbed with salt or wrapped in cloths. No one looked on you with pity or had compassion enough to do any of these things for you. Rather, you were thrown out into the open field, for on the day you were born, you were despised. Nobody cared anything about you. Now God says, I passed by you, saw you kicking about in your blood, and as you lay there in your blood, I said to you, live. I made you grow like a plant of the field. You grew up and developed and became the most beautiful of jewels. Your breasts were formed and your hair grew and you were naked and bare. Later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. Now I'll tell you what, I haven't noticed this. I haven't made connection between this passage in Ezekiel and Boaz and Ruth. But it's very clearly a parallel here, because he laid his garment over her. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you. So what is God doing with Jerusalem? He's marrying her. She becomes his bride. And now he begins to take care of her. And as you read through verses 9 through 14, I washed you, I cleansed you, I clothed you, I adorned you with jewelry. I put ring in your nose, earrings on your ears, beautiful crown on your head. You were adorned with gold and silver. Your clothes were fine linen and costly fabric. Your food was fine flour, honey, and olive oil. You became very beautiful and rose to be a queen. Your fame spread among the nations in account of your beauty, because the splendor I have given you made your beauty perfect, declares the Lord. But then, as you continue reading on, she became a prostitute and used her beauty and fame. And I mean, it's just so plain there. You see the same thing, and we just studied it in our minor prophecy with Hosea. Hosea was told to go marry this immoral woman, and she was a representation of God's marriage with Israel and Judah. So in many cases, when a woman is used, it is not complimentary. It is not a good thing. There are harlots or adulteresses showing their unfaithfulness, and we're going to see that. We already saw it just a minute ago in Revelation 19, where she is, the Jerusalem becomes the great harlot. Someone said that, and I didn't check it, but woman or women is found 19 times in the book of Revelation, and almost rivals in its importance the lamb. And that's impressive to me. So your first question here on this was, who or what is represented by the woman? And I would suggest to you that the woman here is a representative of spiritual Israel. And that's a good thing. We can see by the way she is described that she's pure. She seems to be the faithful wife of God. In fact, if you go over to Revelation chapter 1 and verse 6, you'll find out she's clothed very much like her husband, or described like her husband there, as Jesus is described. And so she is, as the sign indicates, the mother of Christ, figuratively, in general. We're not talking about Mary here. It's not talking specifically about Mary, but about spiritual Israel and the bride of Christ. And I'm going to review this, but let's look at the next slide there, Tim. Isaiah chapter 7, 10 and 11. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. Next slide, or click it again. Again, the Lord said to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deep... Oh, why did I put that on there twice? It's my fault. I think I realized that I'd done that. I thought I corrected it, and I didn't. So I'm going to turn over to Isaiah chapter 7. And then if you skip on down, what I'm going to be doing here in verse 14... is that, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign, the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. And so this is the passage that John is using here, or referring back to here, for this vision. So we've gone from the depths of the abyss to heaven, the exact opposite. And obviously the king refuses to ask for a sign, but one is given to him anyway. And we'll take off with that, verse 14, where the original Hebrew word there is Alma. And people have a question, is that a virgin or is it a young maiden? And I'll clear that up for you for all time next week on Wednesday. And for those of you on Zoom, I'll clear that up for you on Thursday. So remember, the Zoom class next week on Thursday. All right, so I have that marked that there, and I will stop our recording.